Museum of the Moving Image welcomes you to the Pinewood Dialogues Online, an archive of conversations with innovative creative figures in film, television, and digital media. Visit Museum of the Moving Image in New York City or online at www.movingimage.us.
Please welcome Hal Hartley.
Thanks for coming. I just want to point out that David and I went to college together, went to film school together. And when we were at college, he was doing similar things. He was programming all the films that we saw on campus through the Student Senate. So I actually owe a lot to David for most of the films I saw when I started to watch films closely. If I didn't see them in class, I saw them in the evening at the Student Senate. Courtesy David Schwartz.
Start with the Long Island questions. There's a movement, especially now through amateur, which is off Long Island completely, from your student films to amateur, kind of a movement off of Long Island. The presence of the Long Island Railroad is very evident in Trust and Unbelievable Truth. What was the link for you between growing up and leaving Long Island, both for yourself and also in your films? How does it fit into your films?
Well, it... practically, it was just the only place I could make films. I was living there when I began to make films, but even when I was at college in upstate New York, mm-hmm. when I had to make a film project, I would invariably go back to Lindenhurst because there were just environments that I could control, which is something I learned very early about. Most of the time when you go out to shoot and you don't get everything you wanted, mm-hmm. to shoot, it's because you don't have control over the environment. So, I grew up, on a street where a lot of Hartleys lived. You know, they all had houses, different ones, and backyards, and even, I had a lot of cousins I could use as extras. it was also just a supportive kind of environment too. Mm-hmm. But. Still, when it came time to make films that were not student films, and there was still a little bit of that. The Unbelievable Truth, I don't think I could have put together for that amount of money in any other kind of environment. Mm-hmm. I actually wrote it for the street. Mm-hmm. I grew up on, not that it needed to portray that street, but I knew that I could shoot a scene in my father's backyard while the electricians were setting up a scene in mm-hmm. my uncle's backyard. We shot like 20 pages a day. Mm-hmm. Then with Trust, it just seemed, I had been writing, that old adage, I don't know, I think Steinbeck said it, just write about what you know. Since I, at that point, I had spent most of my life there, that's what I knew. Mm-hmm. I knew about my frustration of living in the town I grew up in, as well as the little joys that mm-hmm. I had. So that was sort of natural. Things like the Long Island Railroad, living on an island and a railroad that takes you off the island is a significant thing. Ever since I was a kid, that was significant to me mm-hmm. in the neighborhood I grew up in anyway. All the men got on that train in the morning and went to New York City to work, and then they came back in the evening, and all those kids and housewives, mm-hmm. stayed. Mm-hmm. As a 7-year-old, that was significant to me. Mm-hmm. I wondered, where do they go? as I got older, it was more important because I began to understand that that railroad wasn't just a way off this island, but to other railroads that would take you to other places. It was the way off in the most concrete of terms. And so I've always used it that way. I've always used the Long Island Railroad as a symbol. Mm-hmm. And they keep chasing me off the platform every time. I've never yet gotten a
permit
to shoot. And they always send the police.
you made Simple Man set on Long Island but shot in Texas. What was it like, kind of artistically, being able to recreate a role from scratch and not actually being on Long Island but setting a film there?
Well, it wasn't that hard, really. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we have to face facts. Long Island looks just like every place else in the world, at least in America. It's, you know, a suburb here and a suburb in 2 hours outside of Houston, Texas, look exactly the same. Mm-hmm. And it's flat. I had known that from traveling in Texas before, that it was flat, like much of Long Island is flat, and the foliage is pretty much the same. So when it became an issue that I wasn't going to be able to shoot Simple Man in New York, I figured, mm-hmm. let's go to Texas. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have to work as quickly in Texas. And the light, the daylight is a lot longer in Texas, maybe because it's further south. It's that particular time of the year. But for me, it's the film of mine that is the most nature film. It's bucolic. It's mm-hmm. it's a pastoral. I remember, you know, more than the other films, like looking at the landscape a lot. Even, you know, watching it today, I haven't seen this in about 2 years, but seeing that shot of Dennis coming up the street towards the place where he sees Elena, that's a, you know, that's not the kind of shot you see in my films much. Mm-hmm. You know, it shows a lot. It shows it deep and it shows it wide. Mm-hmm. Without putting up a wide-angle lens, it's still a 50, mm-hmm. but it shows a lot of the landscape, which a combination of circumstance and inclination with the earlier films kept me from doing that.
To go back to Unbelievable Truth for a minute, because this was your transitional film out of school and continued in some ways what you were doing in your filmmaking at Purchase. How were you able to get it made? How were you able to get that project off the ground? And then kind of a second tangential question, do you think about what would happen if you had never made that? I mean, where uh-huh. you might have wound yeah. up.
Well, if I hadn't made The Unbelievable Truth, I probably just would have made some other film, mm-hmm. you know, because if one thing's clear to me now, I was put on this earth to make films. I've never done anything so consistently. And, mm-hmm. Because there was a time when I wasn't that sure if filmmaking was what I should be doing. But, well, yeah, I had been making a lot of short films. And The Unbelievable Truth was something that I had planned to do in 16mm, feature length, but 16mm, for $20,000. And then, you know, my employer at the time, who was going to co-sign a loan I was taking out to do that, he suggested that I try to do another budget for the same project that would let me do it in 35, so that it would be a viable commercial product. And I did, and that came out to about $60,000. And then he got the money. He just put up the money. His company had some money, and they invested it. Mm-hmm. So if that didn't happen, I probably just would have made The Unbelievable Truth in 16mm, first mm-hmm. of all, which has actually become a lot more popular with first-time filmmakers mm-hmm. now. A 16mm feature-length film is no longer a complete non-entity as far as a commercial product, mm-hmm. which is good. It's encouraging.
In school, you know, when you're in film school, you take for granted that you make your own films as a kind of personal expression. I mean, Purchase was definitely a school where nobody was making calling card films. Nobody was making the kind of films that would land them in Hollywood. Yeah. But to be able to continue doing that, making films that continue your personal themes and ideas, but there aren't too many directors who are able to keep doing that. You know, even filmmakers like Scorsese go back and forth between commercial and personal projects. So could you talk a bit about how you're able to maintain that?
Well, first off, I mean, it seems a little miraculous to me sometimes. But realistically, I mean, it's just money. Mm-hmm. I don't make a lot of money. If you don't want a lot of money, people will let you do anything you want. You know? And that's not to say that, you know, Martin Scorsese, you know, makes a lot of money and insists on a lot of money. I think his interests are very different, too. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I knew what my interests were, and I had to admit that they didn't require a lot of money. Mm-hmm. So as long as I made reasonably profitable films with reasonable budgets, mm-hmm. you know, it has not been a problem. That's the dynamic, you know. Mm-hmm. How much money you need, what do you want to do? You know, your integrity is over here as you see it. Mm-hmm. And then how much money do you want to maintain your integrity? If you want $40 million to maintain your integrity, you know, people will be a lot slower in coming with investment.
Right. In some of the scenes we just looked at from Unbelievable Truth and Trust, there are very clear statements from the characters, kind of philosophical statements. I mean, Audrey talking about how life is just deals, mm-hmm. and then the dialogue and trust about love and respect and admiration. You've been able to create a style of in writing and directing where these kind of statements can be expressed overtly, which is, it's dangerous to get into that area, you know, the danger of becoming heavy-handed. So I wonder if you could talk about how you're able to find the right tone to express this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, comedy helps. You know, if you want somebody to say something kind of heavy and to the point, unnaturalistically, so you just figure out a way to have a joke right next to it, or to make it part of a joke that's in the process mm-hmm. of being told. A lot of the people will be saying some kind of philosophical crap, and then eventually it'll turn into a really, you know, just a slapstick kind of thing. Mm-hmm. That said, I mean, I think of speaking as action. I think of people having ideas as action, mm-hmm. because actions have consequences, and so do ideas, you know. As long as I understand why the character is speaking that way, sometimes mm-hmm. they're being jerks, they're being mm-hmm. full of themselves, sometimes they're being really naive. Other times, they're being very sincere.
Yeah.
In my experience, watching a character be sincere is probably the most difficult thing for an audience to watch, to endure. Sincerity is about the hardest thing for any audience to do. And that interests me. That's why I think I kind of play around with what sincerity looks like, how it expresses itself. Mm-hmm.
The characters frequently move back and forth between these kind of lofty ideas and then very earthly concerns.
But you see, that's a way.
Yeah.
That's one of the ways to make the highfalutin dialogue acceptable by somehow grounding it in earthiness and regular, ordinary situations.
So, I mean, the seduction scene, Josh in Unbelievable Truth really seduces Audrey by talking about how gears work and how about
mechanics. But she's an easy mark. He doesn't have to try too hard to seduce that girl at that point.
In a lot of ways, the women in your film are easier to read or easier to it's easier to get inside their heads, where the men in your film tend to be a bit more enigmatic and difficult mm-hmm. to read. So I just wonder if you could talk about kind of different approaches to men and women characters.
Yeah, maybe it's because, I mean, I think most, I think the men's motives are so obvious they don't need to be treated in any special way. But I think it's also my fascination with women that, you know, mm-hmm. they will be mysterious. Mm-hmm. And I'm interested in that. Mm-hmm. It can be argued that my treatment of the characters is uneven, you know. It's heavier on the female characters because I have more questions about the female characters. Mm. I hesitate to just stop there because something like Simple Men really was, for me, a reaction to having dealt in the woman's world and trying to understand women so much, almost to the exclusion of everything else in the previous mm-hmm. film, In Trust. And then I said, wow, I want to concentrate on men a little bit here. And I think the way you ask questions about something that you think you understand a lot mm-hmm. more is different. The kinds of questions you ask will be different. Mm-hmm. Ultimately leads us to the point that you've made, which I think is that, you know, the women seem more... Well, you said the men seem more enigmatic. I mean, I think the women seem more mysterious, even if I do get into their heads.
Right.
Well, maybe they don't. We'll ask people later. To me, they did. They do. That's why I write about them. But I have to see if I cause any kind of illumination.
The characters in your films always seem to be trying to control their lives, to come up with ways to control things, control destiny. They're always making deals. Audrey is always making deals, and characters are always in all your films making some sort of deals. At the same time, there's a lot of kind of chance occurrences and things that just come totally out of left field. How much control do you think your characters really do have?
Well, I think they only have control, really. It's just, when do they realize it? I think they have control over their lives a lot more than, you know, it's not just destiny, it's not just really chance. But recognizing that you do have control and doing something about it is usually what I try to move the stories towards. The characters may flounder around a bit, getting into trouble one kind or another before they realize it. Yeah, I think they have a lot of control. Given that, I also don't believe that there's any real freedom. Mm-hmm. You know, that they may be looking for freedom, and it's just a wrong approach. You know, we're not free. You know, we're constricted by that. That's why deals, I think, are such a useful tool for me. Because it illustrates the way in which you don't get anything for nothing. You can't have something for nothing. To me, that's just the most obvious example of a lack of freedom, fundamentally. You know.
A lot of times the constriction that your characters feel has to do with the work that they do. There's a real interest in people. What kind of jobs do people take? And there's a sense that the kind of 9-to-5 job is very constricting, and especially, you know, Martin Donovan's character in Trust, who just, you know, will never work 9-to-5 without blowing up the building that he's in. In terms of these ideas about control and people deciding what they want to do, how much does this tie into ideas about work and the jobs that people have?
Well, I mean, I don't think it has so much to do with 9-to-5. I mean, I know plenty of people who work 9-to-5. I even myself try to work 9-to-5. The point is that doing work that you don't love diminishes you, and you know, you can get around that any way you want and lie to yourself or whatever, or go out and find yourself a job that you that in one way or another doesn't diminish you. The choice of how we intend to spend the moments of our life is important. It seems really simple, I guess, but I mean, if I chose to be a hitman, or if I chose to be, you know, a drug dealer, or if I chose to be a priest, because it expresses, you know, your connection to the world. I mean, I know most people don't think this way about employment.
Well, there seems to always be a struggle to find that right place. I mean, you have characters who have
It certainly is a struggle. That's what I meant before about there's no freedom. I mean, it's a struggle. So to live is, what does Fritz Lang say in Contempt? To live is to suffer. You know, to live is to struggle. I mean, you can't get around it. But I do think the only freedom we do have is the freedom of choosing what particular struggle we're going to engage in. You know, is it any easier to strive to be a poet today, writing like really flowery poetry or something like that nobody reads, and insisting on that, than it is to like try to become a fighter pilot? You know, it's hard. You know, if you want to do it, and you want to do it your way, it's going to be difficult.
And, you know, often you have characters who seem to be in these dichotomous jobs. I mean, you have a nun who then winds up a nymphomaniac. You have philosopher mechanics. You have, people who seem split in two different directions. Radical, terrorist, shortstop.
Yeah. Well, everybody's looking for, they're in between jobs. Yeah, well, those people are on the margins. You know, they're... they're at that moment probably where, you know, they're deciding that, no, I can't keep doing this, I have to do that. I think that's when, you know, they're in a crisis. You know, people are more interesting when they're in a crisis. Mm-hmm. You never see movies about people who are completely content, who have no wants, you know.
Speaking of malcontents, I want to ask about Martin Donovan, who there's some you tend to work with the same people over and over, and he's somebody who seemed to become an alter ego. I mean, starting with your second film, mm-hmm. and I know you said that Amateur, you know, might be the last film you do with him for a while, but mm-hmm. he seems to really just be perfect in your films, just kind of straightforward, deadpan approach on the outside, but mm-hmm. a lot going on under the surface. So
yeah.
Can you talk about like kind of how you started with how you found him?
Well, just through casting. Mm-hmm. I'd seen a play that he was in at Cucaracha Theater Company, which is a theater company down in Tribeca. And I thought he was pretty good. It was very probable that he could work with me well. Mm-hmm. I talked to him, and it was still a year before I had him come in and read for Matthew. And I think what drew me to him was that I recognized a common rage that's suppressed and common ways of suppressing it. And, you know, Martin is a very kind, you know, mm-hmm. quiet person. But, you know, when he wants to be enraged, and the way he'll talk about rage is exciting. You know? When we made Trust, we recognized that, yeah, we had that in common. It was funny because a lot of times it's mystery about the actor that keeps me wanting to work with them. It's not mm-hmm. just comfort. Mm-hmm. Because really, Martin is not a comfortable person to work with. He's very demanding. He's extremely self-critical. He's a great actor. I think it's not easy to work with him, though. Mm-hmm. We choose to struggle that way rather than mm-hmm. you know, get somebody who just fit it nice and easy and mm-hmm. not give me a hard time. and he does. I like watching Martin on the screen. I mean, he expresses, mysterious rage that I feel. I'm not qualified to act out.
In Amateur, he plays, a character with amnesia. In all of the previous three features, characters are always trying to escape their past. Usually it has to do with their parents, they're trying to escape their parents or some secret in the past. Could you talk about this, how this comes to play in your dramas? I mean, films always are trying to move forward and narrative is always stuck in the present and future, but how the past comes into play.
Okay. Well, first of all, we don't have a character mm-hmm. unless we know our past. I mean, just think, how would you know you're David Schwartz if you didn't remember your past? So I think those questions of what did you say about the earlier films?
Have characters who are trying to either escape their parents.
They're trying to escape the past. It sort of led naturally to this because me and Martin had done up through Simple Men. I mean, and some work after that. Some of my favorite characters. Some of my favorite work with an actor. But we were getting sick of working with each other, I think, a little bit. Just ambitious to work in other ways, on his part a lot more than on mine. So we said, okay, let's make one more film because I want to do something really difficult. Let's start with this premise. You play somebody who has amnesia, you have no past. Because, you see, this is the thing that most actors will do when they're developing a character. Mm-hmm. And you have to give them this. They'll just go home and they'll make up a whole past history of the mm-hmm. character. And it's the soil out of which they start forming their character. So it was a little like gym class. I just said, all right, no past. Let's start from scratch and mm-hmm. see what you can do. And it was hard. And it's very vulnerable, too, I think, for Martin, because every single tiny decision that Martin makes as an actor in the confines of the film contribute to his building of his character. He has no past to draw on, so he can only draw on his the experience, the what he sees, what he hears. So it was a really challenging mm-hmm. way to do it.
The major areas of authorship in film are, first writing and then directing, composing music, and editing, of course. And since you really control all these areas in your films, I just wanted to ask, which you think are the most important or how you feel about these different stages. I mean, Hitchcock is somebody who said that the film is basically over once it's written. So in terms of writing, directing, composing.
Well, I try not to distinguish. Mm-hmm. I try to just think of the writing, the directing, and the editing all as of the same process. It's all making a film. And the composition, to the music composition, which I consider part of the editing. Mm-hmm. No single part of it should be autonomous. Mm-hmm. The script isn't literature. It's a blueprint for the painting that you're going to do.
In all these areas, there's always, especially in your work, a distillation process and an attempt to get to the core of things and the essentials. Your screenplays are incredibly lean and every aspect of these areas. So could you talk about what this process is like? I mean, you after seeing Simple Men, you talked about about all the things you had cut out of the film along the way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think the screenplays appear a lot more lean as they're published because that's the as-produced screenplay. I do cut a lot out. I don't know. It's just the exercise of taste and sensibility. I have certain aesthetic prejudices that something say it's like composing music. You just hear something doesn't. There are too many notes in this phrase. Mm-hmm. There are too many words in this interchange. I just try to get rid of everything that doesn't contribute. What I'm trying to contribute to is different from scene to scene as well.
And then do you have the feeling that there's only one right way to do a scene? I mean, there are directors like Bresson, certainly, Lubitsch, or Hitchcock, where you feel like there's only one possible place to put the camera, one possible mm-hmm. way to cut the film. And there, on the other hand, are directors like Altman who seem to be catching life as it goes on. So. Mm-hmm.
No, I don't think there's... I mean, it just depends mm-hmm. on the person. Mm-hmm. I do believe that each person, if they work enough and are, conscientious about it and honest, will admit after a certain point that they like to see things in a particular way. Mm-hmm. They like to show things in a particular way. Right now, I feel like I know how I like to see things, but I did at college, too, and it's totally different. So you change. I don't think there's one right way. Because most of the time, I think what makes a scene interesting is the combination of what's being said, what's being done, and the interpretation. Mm-hmm. More and more, it's interpretation of things that is interesting to me. Like subject matter, what the story's about isn't really that interesting to me anymore. I mean, I'm interested in how certain subject matter, whatever it is interpreted. That's what, I like that it's too short projects a little, I think, mm-hmm. because they would just hand it to me. They just mm-hmm. said, they didn't give me a script, they just said, make something about New York. It's got to be 10 minutes long in video. Mm-hmm.
There's a real balance in your films between a very close observation of life and how people act and how they behave, and then the fiction side, which is that people do things and say things in your films that are very movie-like that they wouldn't do in life. So what does True Fiction mean to you, which is the name of your production company?
True Fiction, the term True Fiction is something I wrote down when I was at Purchase. At a particular time at Purchase, I was really knee-deep in Wim Wenders, Aram Avakian, mm-hmm. and John Gardner, the novelist. Mm-hmm. All three of them, from different perspectives, were talking about the same thing. It's about fiction. And Wenders had said in an interview about Paris, Texas, that he found it dishonest to write the end of the movie. Because how would he know, really, what the end of the movie would be? Sure, he got a general idea of the situation, but and even the characters, but those characters are going to be played by real human beings who, over the course of time, you really discover that character is no longer just the character, but an amalgam of the character as written and the actor. And that has got to be able to change your interpretation at the end. I like that. I like that kind of talk. because, I mean, it means he takes, as I try to, you know, take fiction very seriously. Because it's a way of being attentive to the world. John Gardner was talking about the same thing, and he said that there comes a point when the making of fiction, I'm paraphrasing him now, but the making of fiction becomes an exercise in humility. That you there comes a point where even though you've started this situation, you've invented some characters, but every step those characters take define that character. And the more steps they take, the less control you have over what's really going to happen. I mean, if you really want to be honest and make fiction that's grounded in character and is interested in taking a look and asking some hard questions about what people are really like. So he said this humility thing, and Wenders had talked about honesty, and Aram talked all the time about, you know, lying in class. You look at a picture that you made last weekend and you're showing, you cut it into the film, and he says, that's such bullshit. You don't believe that at all. This is, you're just trying to finish this film. You're mm-hmm. just trying to make this have a nice ending because you had this preconceived idea about what the film is and how it should end. But, you know, nothing that's happened in the first 20 minutes of your half-hour film would lead me, as open-minded as I am, I'm speaking as Aaron Falkin right now, would lead me to believe that these characters would resolve the situation this way. So it had to be true, and so that's where true fiction comes from.
Or as you once said, true fiction could also be called real bullshit.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, well,
and it is very
often. If we can bring up the Haslites a bit, let's take some questions from the audience.
He's asking about, as a person who continues to make short films, what was my reaction to the controversy at the Academy Awards last year when there was some question of abolishing the short film category. Yeah, I think that's just stupid. although I was not aware of the controversy. I don't watch the Academy Awards.
It's more of a technical question, but how do you think sound should function, and how does money, having more of it, change that?
Yeah, I take sound really very seriously the more I learn about it. Listen, I was standing in the back before listening to the clips of the three films, and I forgot how thin the sound of The Unbelievable Truth was. That was 8 tracks, you know. Whereas Trust probably got up to about 15 tracks at any given point, and then Amateur is a 24-track mix. And we had more time. I mixed The Unbelievable Truth in one day. and I spent the better part of a month with Amateur. So it is important. It can get crazy, too. You know, sound should be part and parcel of... I try not to get into the habit of thinking like I have a film and I'm going to put some sound on it. The movie and the sound are all together and you're going to deal with it as one thing. That's how I try to deal with it. And money changes your ability to make choices. I mean, there are whole parts of Amateur that only have 2 tracks. It's just the recording that we made, you know, the production recording, we call it when we're shooting, and maybe some birds or something. And I like that a lot. With the shorter work I've been doing, whether it's videos like we watched before or shot film projects, I'm working with less and less tracks and trying to make that production recording as dynamic as possible. And it, yeah.
Okay, right down here.
I enjoy your dialogue style very much. It's very vivid. I'm wondering, are you influenced at all by people like David Mamet?
Well, I read David Mamet now because people used to say that a lot.
Oh.
And I have to admit, I was not well read. I think now that I know Pinter and Mamet well, I wasn't actually influenced, but I could see where we all fit into a common vein, which comes from Beckett. The word is just really important.
Okay, right here.
Back. This is kind of a two-prong question.
A two-prong question.
I've noticed that characters in your films it recurs that each of them walks around with the book, and I was wondering what personal experiences made you make that aesthetic artistic choice. And then I guess the second part of my question is whether you realize that Eric Rohmer does that a lot of his movies.
Oh, yeah. Amateur has books, too. Books are just a part of my life, you know, and ideas and articulation is something that, I would say that my frustration in growing up where I grew up had to do with the fact that there wasn't a book in sight ever. So I needed those, I needed them, reading, passing on ideas. To me, that's a real part of life, even though it's very often thought of as being like a very unnaturalistic thing. But the world I move through, there are books all over the place. Today, my favorite Godard film is, it changes all the time. I mean, I think, I try not to think that way anyway, because I think it's very important, especially with an artist of his stature, to not think about an individual, but to think of the body of work. But everything from about the mid-80s to this point, I think, is great. We will be showing Hélas pour moi,
yeah.
Which is this, but also at the Public starting this week,
right.
They're showing JLG by JLG. Which is a portrait film, a self-portrait film he made. And also Alemania,
90, right.
Germany, Year Zero, 1990, yeah. Which is also a great piece.
Okay, right down here.
How much of an idea do you begin with when you start thinking of your next film, and then how much does that change from what you started with to what you finally end up with?
Well, I saw that. Probably a handful of ideas, and they change constantly. Yeah, they start changing less the closer you get to making the film. But in the writing, it's can go on for months and months changing. What I think I'm writing today at the early stages of writing 2 months from now, might not even exist, but it'll get me to something else.
Do you start with titles? You have such elemental titles, that are so evocative. So do those come at the beginning of the...
No, they come out through it. Mm-hmm. My notebook tends to be a little cryptic that way. And also, I was an art student at one time, more weighted towards the graphic arts end than the fine arts. So I like to look at words on a page. And if they can mean more than one thing. And that's better.
Okay, we can take one more question here, and then we're going to take it out in the lobby. So, right here.
Who are some of your favorite directors?
Favorite directors right now? Well, Godard, obviously. Vendors. They tend to be like a sort of older brother group, one generation or two.
Do you like Jim Jarmusch?
Yeah. They compare me to Jim. That's interesting. Yeah. I don't know. I like Jim Jarmusch's films. I just, I don't really see the connection. Although he was a huge encouragement, I got out of film school in 1984, which is when his first film, a very individual kind of film, was a success. And it was really encouraging for a lot of us. Spike Lee, too, the same year, these two really popular, I mean, really successful, but idiosyncratic films were a big hit. So that helped a lot of us get the gumption to continue.
Please join us again tomorrow afternoon, and we'll be out in the lobby in just a minute. But thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. The Pinewood Dialogues at Museum of the Moving Image are made possible by generous support from the Pannonia Foundation. To learn more about the museum, visit www.movingimage.us.